It's the Brady and the Bunch podcast, presented by 101.3 The Game.
Welcome back into the Brady and the Bunch podcast. Today is Thursday, May 23rd. Big episode, episode number 25. I said the other day, our goal is to, you know, I want to see this thing grow and grow and grow and get to 100 by the time we're all said and done. So we are now a quarter of the way through, and the guy who's helping us get there is Brad from Essex. Brad, thanks for being with us, man. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you joining us. You emailed me about reaching out. Now, you are a diehard New York sports fan.
That I am.
Do you feel like a fish out of water where you are?
When I first got up here, it was a little shocking. And then something really strange happened is I would see these Red Sox / Giants fans.
Yeah, I've never really gotten when you have it's like crossbreeding. I've never really gotten that.
Yeah. Well, I dug a little deeper and I found out that the Giants in the 50s used to do their preseason up at
St. Mike's. Yeah.
So you had a lot of these kids that would go and see them, and then it started to make sense. But that was a bit of a shock.
Now, are you from New York originally?
I am. I'm from right in the city.
Really?
Yep.
So how long have you been up here?
Came here to go to UVM.
Okay, you don't have an accent.
Very, very intentionally.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you control it?
No, it's just something I worked on for many years. Both of my parents are from Brooklyn.
Okay.
And that's a very distinct accent.
So when you hear Arnie talk, does it feel like you're back home?
Most definitely.
Is that good or bad?
It depends on what he says.
So diehard New York fan, but the traditional New York teams, Yankees, Giants, Rangers, or the new wave, Islanders, Mets, Jets?
No, that's kind of – it's sectioned off a little bit. Manhattan, the Bronx tend to be the traditional. And then as you get to the boroughs, Queens, where the Mets are, you get into the Mets, Jets. So I was in Manhattan. I am a diehard Yankee, Giants, Knicks, Rangers.
Is that really how it's done? Because I always felt like the New Yorkers who have been there for generations, they were your Yankee Giant fans, and kind of the new money people were the Jet Met fans. But you're telling me it's more location rather than age or time of family spent in New York.
That's the way that I've always seen it. Yeah, that's the way I've seen it play out.
So you're a diehard Giants fan. You know, we've had our first OTAs this week. How do you feel now about the state of the franchise?
I'm still trying not to be bitter. And
bitter about what? Just everything?
Everything. Everything. The Gettleman era.
You don't like Gettleman?
I would say I'm probably in the majority of Giants fans who are not huge Gettleman fans.
And what's the biggest reason? You don't like the Odell trade?
I don't love the Odell trade. I don't love the pick at 6. It just seems like he says he has a plan, but the plan doesn't seem to be very succinct.
My biggest issue with the Giants is I don't know exactly what their direction is.
Exactly.
And look, and I don't want to see my team tank either. So I'm not even saying I want them to go that route. I'm just saying, like, you got to be clear in what your direction is. I don't hate Gettleman, and I'm not a Giant fan, so it's a little bit easier to be wishy-washy about it. But I don't hate Gettleman. I do think he's a strong personality. I do think the Giants needed a culture change. I do think that they are trying to harken back to the tough love Tom Coughlin era, and that's what Gettleman brings you. So I see that rationale. But I don't know if they're the team that's going for it, they're not doing a good enough job at going for it. If they're the team that is trying to get younger and acquire picks and acquire more talent, they're not doing that either. So they're not good enough to be 12-4. They're not bad enough to be 4-12. So here we are in another year where it feels like, hey, 5-11 at the worst, 9-7 at the extreme best. And you're not good enough to win the Super Bowl, and you're not bad enough. Like, getting a number 12 pick in the first round is about the worst thing that you can do, and that's where it feels like they're headed.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was saying, there doesn't seem to be a real plan, although he says he has one. And if the real plan is Daniel Jones, then I just don't know.
Let me ask you this, though. And this is the biggest thing with a lot of fans. How much Duke football did you watch this year?
I didn't watch any Duke football.
Zero. So where does your hate of Daniel Jones come from?
It's not hate.
Where does the questioning of the pick come from?
It's a value. It's a value proposition. It's not Daniel Jones himself. It's Daniel Jones at 6.
Okay, so you would. What if they got him at 17?
I would have been okay with it because we would have gotten that value at six that we really needed.
And what if Daniel Jones is no longer available at 17? Because, again, I love these people that are like, he would have been there at 17. You have no idea.
No, we
you
don't know.
Zero idea. Denver needed a quarterback. Miami needed a quarterback. This was pre the Josh Rosen trade. And you never know who's going to trade up. Now, Denver, once Jones got picked, Denver traded back. Maybe Jones was their guy and they would have taken him at 10.
It's possible. There are options. There were options. I'm going to reserve judgment on Daniel Jones.
You're not reserving judgment. You've told us that you don't like Gettleman already, so you're not reserving judgment.
Well, that's Gettleman. That's not Daniel Jones. I don't like how Gettleman has run the organization for the last couple of years. I think he's made some very questionable decisions. Daniel Jones, like you said, I haven't seen him play a whole lot. What I have seen, I haven't been highly impressed, but I'm not a quarterback guru.
Let me say this. The Giants are in the position they are in because of Jerry Reese, not Dave Gettleman. Jerry Reese's draft history was horrendous. You have Landon Collins, you have Odell Beckham, and man, I used to have the running list in my head. You have about four good picks in what seems to be about 7 years of guys that really, really lasted for the Giants. That's your problem. When you swing and miss in the draft every time, and you end up with one useful player per year out of seven rounds, then you end up in a position where the Giants were a couple years ago, where Jerry Reese is fighting for his job, and now you're going out and you're spending all this money in free agency. Olivia Vernon, Janoris Jenkins, Damon Harrison. You make the playoffs and everybody looks happy, but then you're saddled with, well, what happens when they get injured? Which they did. What happens when they get older? Which they did. And now they're expensive. And now you can't turn the roster over because you're hampered by money, so you can't get younger in free agency. And you haven't drafted well, so you can't replace them with young talent there. You swing and miss on Eli Apple in the first round. You end up trading him out, 2 years into his career. Like, that's where the problem is. So, Gettleman, I understand the way New York fans operate, where Gettleman has to come in here and save the franchise in a season. But, I mean, this is a 6-7 year losing prospect that was put on by Jerry Reese.
No question. Jerry Reese was not the man for the job, and they hung on a little bit too long on that one. I just don't know that Gettleman is the leader that he portrays himself to be. He's been to 7 Super Bowls, he says. Carolina is the only one that I can think of.
Well, he was with the Giants. Remember, he was with the Giants a long time before.
But he was not in an executive position at that point. He was in a scouting position, I believe.
Yeah, but still, you're still a guy bringing in talent and evaluating talent.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. Like
you
said,
just sound
I'm learning.
This is what I fight every day. Yeah. This is what I fight every day. Arnie's emotional. Rich is emotional. Fans are emotional. Where is the logic in this? And I don't portray to be a draft guru either. I don't know if Daniel Jones is going to work out, and I don't know if any moves they've been. And look, again, I don't love what the Giants have done, but to sit here and say that this is Gettleman's fault, that is an emotional fan reaction because you need to look at it goes a decade deeper than that.
So certainly, something that I think you said and I've heard other radio hosts say as well is that if you look at the totality of that first round, it's not a bad haul. When you're saying, you're going to get a defensive lineman, you're going to get the best cornerback in the draft, and you're going to get a quarterback when it's all said and done.
You're going to have them for 5 years.
That's okay. It's that value proposition that I was going back to.
The thing that I don't like about what the Giants have done under Gettleman is this. One, they drafted Kyle LaLeta last year in the third round or the fourth round.
Fourth round.
That's going to be a wasted pick. Absolutely. Now because if he's even on the roster, he's going to be the third string quarterback, and there's a good chance that he gets cut outright. So there's a lot of value in NFL drafts in the fourth round. Now you've taken a fourth rounder, and it's been a throwaway. Now, it wasn't Gettleman's pick, but it's the same thing with Davis Webb a couple years ago. They get him in the third round out of Cal, and that's a spot where you get NFL starters and Pro Bowlers and all-pro players, and now he's gone and off your roster 3 years into his career. So those are two wasted picks, one of which is by Gettleman. I hate that. The other thing is that, and I believe, look, I'm sentimental. I believe Eli should play as long as he's capable of playing this year. And I believe Jones needs the opportunity to sit and learn because we agree that while he's talented, that he's raw. I don't think it's the best thing in the world for Jones to come in and play in week 4. I don't think he'd be ready for that. And then you'd be feeding him to the Wolves, and I think that would be bad too. So you let Eli play this year. Then Jones plays next year and invariably goes through some struggles that a rookie quarterback goes through. And then you hope that he pops in what is year 3 for him, but his second year as a starter. And by that point, You're 4 years into Saquon Barkley's career, and as good as Saquon Barkley is, you're going to have a 1 to 2 year window where he's on his rookie contract. You very well may be wasting the prime of Saquon Barkley's career, and by the time your quarterback is ready to play, well, Golden Tate will be gone again, and Evan Engram will be gone again if he ever pops, and then Barkley's going to be ready to leave, and now you're going to be struggling to find talent all over again.
Right, and Sterling Shepard, and that's really what you got on the offense.
So
no question.
That's really where I quibble with what the Giants have done. But I do like Edelman and the fact that I do think he's a strong leader, and the Giants need that discipline. Okay, they lost that discipline under Ben McAdoo. They lost it as Jerry Reese is trying to fight for his job. They lost it when they got rid of Coughlin. That's clearly what they're trying to go back to there. And Gettleman is that guy. I don't have a problem with that. But it's going to take more than a year for him to undo this.
What was your take after one full season on the Saquon versus Darnold?
You know what? I would have taken the quarterback. There's no doubt in my mind that I would have taken the quarterback. That said, you can't argue with the results. I mean, Saquon Barkley is a rookie of the year caliber player. He's an all-pro caliber player. Not that I'm hugely into fantasy football, but like he's a stat machine where he's potentially the number one pick in everyone's fantasy league. Like, you got a great player. Dave Gettleman said at the number two pick in the draft, we want a Hall of Fame caliber player. You have got a Hall of Fame caliber player there. So you can't quibble with the results. It's just, it doesn't appear to me that it's going to line up that when the quarterback of the future is ready, that Barkley is also going to be there and be in his prime. Or you're going to be in a position where you massively overpay a running back, which now we know is not great, in order for him to stay there. And then now you've got a bunch of money tied up in a running back, and that's not value-wise the best thing. So,
right. Look,
I think Darnold has the capability of being good. Obviously, we saw that, Rosen struggled, Allen struggled. So, I don't know. Look, I would have taken the quarterback. I thought it was the biggest need. However, you can't argue with what they've gotten out of Barkley.
No, I mean, Barkley is a generational talent. I mean, there's no question. He is fun to watch. I love the guy. I love the energy he brings and the positivity he brings, and that's kind of the anti-OBJ.
Now, are you an OBJ hater?
No. God, no. His talent is insane. I mean, absolutely insane.
A lot of Giant fans, surprisingly to me, happy to see him gone.
No. I mean, I think there are things we don't know about. That went on internally. There had to be. That's the only thing I'm kind of banking on. But talent-wise, it's really hard to swallow getting rid of a talent like that for a first, a third, and a marginal safety.
Again, I guess the thing with Gettleman is that you signed Beckham last year, and it gave the impression, okay, we're going for it. And if you were going to trade him, we could have traded him last year and gotten all the picks and started this process a whole year sooner.
Right.
So, look, and again, I guess credit to Gettleman in that he recognized after 1 year, okay, that was the wrong thing going for it. And that's exactly what he was doing. The thing that we don't know about is this, and I always equate it to the Mariners, and the listeners hate that, but that's why it's okay to do that on my own podcast. I can do that. When the Mariners ownership got changed over, the GM got changed over, they said, can you win with our older core? Nelson Cruz, Robinson Cano, Felix Hernandez, Kyle Seager. These are older players we've invested a lot of money in. Can you win with that? You have to win with that. There is no trading out these guys. You have to win with these guys. And they said, yes, fine. We will go about changing our roster to fit those guys. And now 3 years in, they've sold off a lot of those pieces because it didn't work. But they were told by ownership, you have to make this work. I don't know that Dave Gettleman wasn't given the job under the pretense, you have to win with Eli, you have to do what you can to win with Eli Manning. And if he was given that stipulation, well, then everything from a year ago makes sense, doesn't it? You sign Beckham long term, you keep him, you give Eli more help on offense, then you draft Barkley, a guy who's going to help Eli now. I don't know that Gettleman wasn't given the job under those pretenses.
Because I don't know. It doesn't sound like the Mara style.
But the embarrassment,
longtime fan.
But the embarrassment of what you endured in 2017 when Eli's benched and McAdoo here and Reese getting fired, like there's a lot of stench on the organization at that point. So I don't know that they said, look, we wronged Eli. He's won us two Super Bowls. You have to do what you can to make him look good at the end. And you have to do what you can to help us win now with him. I don't know that that wasn't the case. And if that
I don't
was,
know. And where's Pat Shurmur fall into all this? I mean, that would be the other question.
In terms of what? Because I like Pat Shurmur.
I do too. I mean, he did an amazing job with the Vikings. I just want to see it come to fruition. And I think maybe OBJ wasn't a Pat Shurmur guy, and that has something to do with it as well.
The Giants' schedule last year was so unbelievably brutal. The first half of the year. Look, pat myself on the back. Like, I spotted that one from a mile away, that they were destined for 1-7 at the beginning of the year. It was like their whole team, or their whole schedule in the first half of the season, was nothing but playoff teams from the year before. They were set up for a bad road last year. I think their schedule this year is still difficult, but it's a lot friendlier at the beginning of the year. I think, as I recall off the top of my head, this one gets harder towards the middle and end of the year. But, I mean, they could be in a position where they could be 4-3, 5-4 somewhere early, and then you don't know what happens.
I think that's the beauty of it. That's why we love it, because we don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, you could go worst to first. You look at the NFC South every year. It's a worst to first.
Now, football is your favorite sport?
Football's my favorite sport to watch. I'm a very passionate baseball guy. I'm a former player as well.
At where?
Thank you. I was a New York City high school player, and I came up to UVM to play, but I had gotten hurt and did not play up there.
That's the story of every former athlete. Well, I would have been drafted if not for that injury. You know that's the story.
Yeah, I actually was scouted by the Houston Astros. The super of my building was a Hispanic guy named Hector, and he
knew a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy.
He had a family member who was a scout for the Astros, who was a Latin scout, and he came and scouted me, and we had some talks. But I knew that at 5'8" power hitter who played third base, I was better off going to college.
Leave that part out. Just tell everyone that they didn't offer you enough money. I was worth more than what they were offering.
Yeah, that's true.
So just leave it at that. So you're a big Yankee guy. As we record this, the Yankees continue to roll over everybody.
Unbelievable.
How impressed are you by what they're doing?
I'm highly impressed. I mean, it's smoke and mirrors. Like, how are they doing this?
They win on Monday after being down 6-1 against Baltimore and come back and win 10-7. I had pretty much put my phone away thinking that game was over. And then I go back and check it a couple hours later, and I see they won 10-7. I'm like, where the hell did this come from?
Yeah, I did too. You love the pieces. You love that the younger guys are getting to play. Glaber's been great. You know, it's been fun to watch. And now we're starting to see some guys get a little healthier, and we'll see what happens moving forward.
You know, we talk about Dave Gettleman. Brian Cashman does not get enough credit for what he did with the Yankees. I want to say it was 2015. It was my last year in Albany. And I've mentioned this a number of times on the show or on Champlain Valley Game Night, but it just keeps bearing worth repeating. The Yankees were going for it. They went for it. They had Aroldis Chapman, who they traded for from Cincinnati. Then they got Andrew Miller also, who they had for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And they were nasty. Those guys were great. And come 2015 trade deadline, they trade Andrew Miller to Cleveland. They get a nice haul for him that includes Justice Sheffield was in that trade. Now it's going to escape me, but it'll come back to me. But you get Justice Sheffield in that trade. And then they trade Chapman to the Cubs, and they get Gleyber Torres. So they did kind of this rebuild on the fly where all of a sudden they reshaped their minor league system, and then Chapman comes right back to them in free agency the next year, and you end up with him too. So you get Chapman and Torres. I mean, I love what he did. And he also traded Carlos Beltran at that time to Texas, if I'm not mistaken. They got a couple of prospects there. Like, I love what Cashman did. You talk about rebuilding on the fly. He did that.
No question. And that's New York. You know, New York doesn't handle adversity very well from a sports standpoint. You need to be either making waves, making headway, or saying flat out, we are rebuilding. And I know when my friends and I would talk, we thought that at that point it was going to be a rebuild because it seemed like it was heading down that road. And he
twisted. I think Brian McCann got traded around that time too, maybe in the offseason. Yeah, I think they traded him to Houston at that point.
Yep.
So I loved what he did there.
Yeah.
Did you grow up going to a bunch of Yankee games, being in the rowdy bleacher creatures?
I didn't go bleacher creature. I was a little more privileged, let's say, and we had tickets right on the third base dugout.
So therefore, you were nicer than the average fan.
I mean, I was passionate too. And
did you ever say anything you regret?
At a game? No. One of the funniest things, though, excuse me, it was up here. And we used to go up to Montreal to watch the Yankees when they would come and play the Expos.
Yeah.
And Jeter was probably in his, third season or so.
Okay.
And he had just gotten hurt. He had a knee injury. It was really one of the only injuries that he really had, serious injuries that he had. And we're sitting right about the same place on the third base side, right next to the dugout. And I look over, and Derek Jeter's standing about 3 feet away from me. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, you know, you got to take this opportunity. What are you going to say to Derek Jeter? What do you say to Derek Jeter?
Did you completely whiff?
I gave it,
talking to a girl in middle school. It's like,
your hair looks good.
Like, and your voice cracks, yeah. Like, you know, things like that.
It was kind of like, how's the knee?
Yeah.
Hey, Derek. Like, oh, good.
Knee okay? Yeah, mm-hmm. I had a little knee problem myself back in the day. You'll be good. Yeah. But, Yankee fans are crazy. I used to be afraid to go to Yankee Stadium as a kid. Like, it was a scary place to be. And if you wore opponent's gear, I mean, forget about it. I was at a Cleveland Indians and Yankees game, and the Yankee fans gave Manny Ramirez his picture on the Jumbotron of the finger. Like, not even Manny Ramirez, his picture on the Jumbotron when they announced the lineups. I was wearing a Mariners hat at the Yankees-Indians game, and the Bleacher Creatures booed me. I was a 10-year-old kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
A 10-year-old kid wearing a hat of a team that wasn't even playing.
Well, you know who's even worse, and you'll probably know it right off the bat, Philly.
I've never been to Philly.
Oh my
God. As far as going to a game, and I've flown through Philly, but I've never been out in Philly with any substance.
Sure. I was at a Mets Phillies game many years ago, and a guy in all Mets garb came flying over the top of the bleachers from one deck to another.
Wow!
Yeah,
unbelievable. Yeah. So they threw him off.
They threw him off. They're like, just get out of here. Toss him right over the deck.
Sounds like a criminal act to me. The worst thing I ever saw at any game at Yankee Stadium was there was a Japanese tour bus that had gone to watch Ichiro. And it was early in Ichiro's career. Maybe not his rookie year, but maybe second or third year. And this is when he was playing for the Mariners. And he ultimately went and played for the Yankees, but he was playing for the Mariners. And there was a really, really drunk guy, like obscenely drunk, in a Dave Winfield jersey, just making racial epitaphs at this group of Japanese tour bus people, and I don't know if they if a majority of them spoke any English at all. For their betterment, I hope they didn't.
Sure.
Because it was that was the worst thing I've ever seen in person at a stadium. The NFL has worse fans than baseball. Like, the NFL fans get really, really drunk and they get really, really into it. I haven't been to enough NFL games to have really seen that, but I think bleachers at the upper deck of football stadiums is worse.
I would imagine. Again, in Philly, where they have their own court system in the building.
Yes. I saw a guy streak on the field at Yankee Stadium once, and I learned that Yankee Stadium had a jail underneath it at old Yankee Stadium.
Most beautiful stadium in the world right there.
I hate that place.
Oh, walking out through those gates, seeing that field, that was spectacular.
Look, Yankee Stadium,
I lived for that.
Yeah, the history was great, but man, the ghosts in there were very, very real. Every time, you know, the Mariners needed to be up by five for me to feel confident. If it was within Grand Slam range, I felt like it was going to come crashing down upon me. I was at game one of the 2000 ALCS between the Mariners and the Yankees. Mariners won that game 2-0. It was Denny Nagel against Freddie Garcia. A-Rod homered, and Ricky Henderson was playing for the Mariners at the time, at the end of his career. Mariners won 2-0, but I don't even think I watched the ninth inning. I was like, I was like 13 years old. No, 11 years old, and I think I was probably hiding in my dad's shoulder the entire ninth inning. I just couldn't watch.
Well, you got Jay Buhner for Ken Phelps. I'll never forget one.
Yeah, and you got Tino Martinez you got Tino Martinez for Sterling Hitchcock and Russ Davis. So
yeah,
thank you for that. And Jeff Nelson also was traded. We just had Jeff Nelson recently Flashback Friday. As a Yankee fan, have you been listening to Flashback Friday?
It usually hits about my drive time, so yes.
Well, that's why we put it on at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
So, you know, our former Yankees have been great, actually. We've had Jeff Nelson, we've had Dick Swisher, and we've had David Justice. And that's been a lot of fun. And it's, our next one comes out tomorrow, so I won't tell you who's on tomorrow already, but we're working. Tomorrow should be very good, too. So
what do you alternate, Yankees-Red Sox?
In a perfect world. It doesn't always work that way. And, like, nobody who's a listener cares about the struggle of booking guests. Like, they just want to know who's on, and, you know, here's who's on, and that's great. They don't want to know who you tried to get and couldn't, who didn't respond, who said no, who had to reschedule. They don't want to hear that, so I never bother to tell it. But in this form, maybe we can get into it a little bit more. It's really interesting in that it probably takes, my guess would be, 5 reach outs to get 1 success every week that we do this. So it's hard to book these guests. It's a lot of fun. I mean, I've said this on other podcasts. Like, one of the things I love about the business is the thrill of going after guests. One of the most deflating things about the business is getting told no, or no, I can't, or not getting a response. Those are like the things that just deflate you. So it probably takes five people to reach out to get 1 yes. So right now it has worked out where it's been. I think we had 2 Yankees in a row once because it just worked out that we're the Red Sox guys. I wasn't getting back positive feedback for that week. But in a perfect world, I try to do that.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like kind of any sales job where you swing and miss a lot more than you connect.
Yeah, but I think in sales, at least you get told no, whereas with this, sometimes you just get no response. Because
yeah, sometimes it takes a little while.
I've done a good job at acquiring contact information for people. But look, you don't know that the phone number that you have is the most active phone number. Like, I tried to reach out to one guy, and I won't say who it was, but I tried to reach out to one guy and ask him to come on as part of Flashback Friday, and the guy responds back to me, "This is not who you're looking for. My name is Rick." So either this former baseball player just lied to me and told me his name was Rick, or this former baseball player's number is no longer that number. So, like, that was one that I tried to get that didn't end up working out because it wasn't even who I thought it was.
Right. So it was not Rick Cerrone.
It was not Rick Cerrone. Okay. It was I was looking for Ryan Dempster, former Red Sox. That's mm-hmm. what I was looking for, and it wasn't Ryan. It was Rick. So Rick from whoever, from wherever. Are you a salesperson?
I am not a true salesperson. I work for the Red Cross.
Okay.
And as
so
you,
a nonprofit salesperson.
I guess you would kind of call it sales.
A recruiter of blood donations?
I am a recruiter. So I'm an account representative who recruits for drives itself. So when you drive around and you see blood drive today through Chittenden County and through the whole northwest of Vermont, I'm the person that put that drive together. Hmm. I am not the one who goes to the drive. I pass it off to a collection staff. But I'm the one who books all of that.
How much work goes into that?
A lot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
More than
you would think.
I think the naive answer is, that must be pretty easy because it's charity. Like, there's not – now, correct me if I'm wrong. If just say you set up at Brady's Bar and Grill and out front you're having a blood drive, is Brady's Bar and Grill paying the Red Cross or is it all free because it's charity? So,
no.
So because it's free, my mind immediately goes to, okay, there's no money changing hands, so it must be pretty easy. That's not the case, though.
It's not the case. There's a lot of requirements that the FDA requires, that the Red Cross requires on the site itself. So to find a site that's the right size, that has the certain number of outlets. I mean, there's a whole bunch of requirements.
Hmm.
That's got air conditioning, which can be challenging in the summer. And we run in a lot of churches and schools and things like that. A lot of them don't have air conditioning. And you need a commitment from a sponsor who is dedicated,
okay.
who is willing to put some time in to try to get people in, because it doesn't do any good for us to go to a drive and really just sit there. You know, it doesn't do anything for the patients that are in need of blood.
I'm terrified of needles. I have given blood to the Red Cross before, but I am terrified every time. And I just... Is that something you find? Like, is that the biggest deterrent of why somebody doesn't come to a drive because they're just afraid?
It is a big deterrent. The other piece is that 90% of the people who say that they've never given is because they've never been asked.
Mm, really?
Yeah, yeah. Which
I feel like I see blood drives all the time.
All the time. But if you're just driving by as a you know, in a passive mode, you're not being asked. You're not. You know, nobody's coming to you and saying, "Hey, here's the need that we have." And until, you know, your mother, your brother, your sister, your friend is in a car accident, has cancer, something along those lines, and really needs that blood, there isn't the switch doesn't always flip until it becomes a personal story.
So I'll put you on the spot. since you have the microphone right now, where is there a next drive that you're working on?
So right around the corner from here, I have them all over the state, but in Chittenden County, we are partnering with the Chittenden County Sheriff's Department.
Okay.
On their Click It or Ticket campaign.
Oh, nice.
And that goes hand in hand as people get injured and trauma and all those, you know, not good things. That need for blood goes up, especially in the summer. So right around the corner on Ethan Allen Parkway in South Burlington, which is, I mean, literally around the corner from here, is a Click It or Ticket drive that's happening next Tuesday.
So what's the most rare type of blood?
It's O. O negative.
What percentage of people have that kind of blood?
About 9%.
You're not a doctor, so I won't ask you too deep, but I'm kind of curious, like, is there any kind of factor that leads someone to have that kind of blood, or just totally luck of the draw?
So from what I've gathered, there is some genealogy involved.
Okay.
So it's very funny, and I was actually talking to somebody about this yesterday at the Click It or Ticket event. There are pockets of Vermont that have huge pockets of O.
Really?
Yeah, and they're more in your smaller rural communities and things like that.
Hmm.
So
why is that?
Some of that may have to do with the communities being very small. They've been there for many years. You know, the mother and the brother and cousins and everybody's in the same area.
Gotcha. So people aren't being fanned out as much either. So that's part of it. So yeah, you're not getting where you and I have moved around. You're getting some of these people that have stayed in one location, and these families are big families and they have grown and now they're all in one area. So that's definitely interesting too. Crazy. What happens to how is the blood stored? Again, I don't want to get too into blood because I get sick just thinking about needles and blood, but like, okay, we have our A box, our B box, our O box. Is that how it goes?
So everything goes back to the blood center in Burlington. And then it goes to Dedham, Mass.
Okay.
Gets shipped overnight.
Have you ever seen Seinfeld?
I love Seinfeld.
Okay. Like big time?
Big time.
Okay. So there's the episode where Kramer is storing his own blood. He's got a blood bank. And then Jerry falls and he goes, "You got 2 pints of Kramer in you, buddy." Yeah. That's all I'm thinking of right now is Kramer just driving around with this blood in the back of his van. He's got the air conditioner going, trying to keep it cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little more technical than that. Yeah. A little more scientific, I think. But it goes down to Dedham, Mass. They sort it. They have to test it before it can go back to the hospitals.
Okay.
One of the great things about Vermont is that we are, because we're a smaller state, we keep the majority of the blood in-state.
In-state.
So most of it goes to UVM Medical Center, and then everything else will get fanned out to smaller hospitals around the state.
How'd you get into this business?
It's kind of a funny story. I worked for as a sales manager for a massive telecommunications electronics company.
So just like everybody else, you went to college, got a degree, and ended up doing one thing and then changed careers completely.
Completely. Well, I worked in the restaurant business for about 20 years first.
Okay. Locally?
Yeah.
Anywhere we've been that you care to talk about?
Yeah, I'm sure there are places that you have been. Some of them are no longer around.
Okay.
But I worked for the New England Culinary Institute for a while.
Okay.
At a place on Church that they had on Church Street, another restaurant on Church Street. Been in a number of different places.
Okay,
I was in management for there. Got out of that. It was too much. It's a crazy life.
Yeah.
In the restaurant business, but I worked for Samsung for about 7 years.
So you've totally changed fields many, many times.
Yeah, and that was as a sales manager, and I had a territory around Vermont and Plattsburgh and Upper New Hampshire. And there were some changes going on over there. And I'm thinking to myself, I did a lot of driving. I'm thinking to myself one day, man, this is getting tiring. We've got a new boss coming in again and this and that. You know, like I really love to do something more for the community, more, you know, to make a difference. And literally an hour later, I got a call from a recruiter from the Red Cross.
And then you were hooked.
I was like, yeah, this is the world trying to tell me something. Huh. So let's do it.
And very, very cool.
Jumped in and Doing it.
Brad from Essex joining us here on the Brady and the Bunch podcast. And you can do exactly what Brad did. If you want to be on the podcast, you can join. You can email me, brady@1013thegame.com. We drop these every Tuesday, every Thursday, as close to noon as we can. So you can find it on Facebook, at 101.3 The Game, on Twitter, at 101.3 The Game, or subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Spreaker, wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating. Help us bump up the charts there. And, you know, appreciate everybody who's been listening, because I've gotten a lot of really, really good feedback, especially on social media and on the text line about this. So, Brad, this is the part of the podcast where I give the guest co-host a chance to ask me 3 questions, and they continue to be really, really interesting. Lauren Maloney, the news anchor at Local 2244, mm-hmm. She kind of stumped me with one of her questions on Tuesday, so I'm interested to see what you've got for me. It could be about the business, about the show, about the station, about whatever you want.
Let's go with where does the Seattle love come from?
You haven't listened to the show enough then, because I lived in Seattle.
I think I remember hearing that.
For 6 years, yeah. So... I was not born there, but I say that I grew up there. I moved to Seattle when I was 1, lived there until I was 6. So, you know, from 1 until 6. So again, it's weird. You know, I don't remember a lot of it. What I do remember is I remember going to my first games there. I remember going to the Kingdome and walking up the winding staircase to go to Mariners games and taking the monorail around town to get there and going to the first Seahawks games of my life. So, that is where there was a brief period of probably about a year where I really started liking the Braves. And the reason why is because when I moved from Seattle, we moved to North Carolina. So number one, you weren't seeing any Mariners games. Number two, the Braves were on TBS at the time. So they were the only team that you could see all around the country. So the Braves were good. They'd gone to the World Series. You know, they'd been in the World Series. They had won the division, you know, all those years in a row, pretty much almost every year of my life, they'd won the division. So they were good. They were on. They were there. Griffey had gotten traded to the Reds. Griffey got traded to the Reds actually about 99, so this is still while Griffey's there. But just kind of the accessibility to the Braves kind of brought me into Braves fandom for a year or two. And then I don't remember why it switched back, why I ended up going back to the Mariners. But other than that, I've been a Mariners fan my entire life. So that's where it comes from, though.
Yeah, I thought I recalled that you were from that area at one point.
Yes, at one point.
So, so sticking with the Seattle theme, is DK Metcalf worth a late-round flyer in fantasy?
Yes, considering Doug Baldwin just retired. So since Doug Baldwin just retired from the Seahawks, DK Metcalf will step into the number 2 wide receiver spot. They just gave Russell Wilson the biggest contract in history. I do believe they're still going to be a power football team. I do think they're still going to run a lot. But Metcalf's big playability, if they run the ball well, it's going to open up play action. And it seems like Metcalf at this point in his career is pretty much a one route runner. He's just going to run a fly. So I don't know how deep your league goes, but I would imagine in a standard 12-team league, you could probably get him in the 9th round or so, 10th round. I would take a flyer on that.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of them.
You're a big fantasy football guy?
I'm a pretty big fantasy football guy, yeah.
We do this all the time with Rich. Tell me at least you're paying for money, because if you're playing for free, then we just wasted the last 40 seconds of my life.
So I play in a number of different leagues under different formats. Some are for free. Some are for money. The longest league that I've played in, we've been going since 2008, I believe.
Okay.
And those are former coworkers from – few jobs back.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of fun. But I'll often just pick up public leagues because I want to try a new style, you know, play with a defense, an IDP, so an individual defensive player, or
yeah,
multiple players, or 2 quarterback league or things like that. So I'll play in a number of different leagues. But beyond my standard league, I'll do some kind of interesting format that I want to try.
I have no desire ever for free fantasy leagues. I'm in 4 baseball leagues, all of which are money. One as low as $30, one as high as $200. So I got money invested in this. So when Rich comes in here and talks about his fantasy team, so I'm like, dude, you're playing for nothing. I don't care. I got real dollars on the line here, like
right,
real parts of my savings.
Well, he's only betting a dollar at a time, too, and
yes,
gambles.
When he gambles, he only bets a dollar at a time. And to him, that's like the biggest thing in the world. So, but hey, to each their own. I will say this, it keeps it interesting.
Absolutely.
Even if you're betting a dollar, it does keep it interesting.
Yeah.
You got a 3rd question. Anything you've ever wanted to know about the show, the station, how we operate?
I mean, it's great to see the station because there's a different visual that I will have when I listen to you guys. What sort of success do you see and what kind of impact do you see from your text line?
The text line has been really, really big. And I'll be honest, I was hesitant when we first got it. I wasn't against it because I'm for anything that brings in listener interaction. And look, it's old school radio to just sit here and take 100 calls. Like that's WFAN in New York. There are not many places that do that. It's hard, you know. People listen when they're driving. Cell phone laws are what they are. People can't call as much. You know, we got a lot of stuff on Twitter. We get some stuff on Facebook. But I was for anything that promotes interaction because, look, this is really your show and we're just kind of navigating it. Sure, we put it together. We plan it. But we're talking about the things that we think you're talking about. And we talk about, you know, when we put stuff on Facebook throughout the day, what's getting reacted to the most. So it's we're navigating what we think is your show. So since we think that the fans have part ownership of the show, we want them to have increased participation in the show. So the text line's been great. I was hesitant at first because I thought we were going to get into this point where it ended up being where we would just start reading for the text line constantly and we would never advance the conversation. Like, we get 200 text messages on the first 10 minutes of the show and we spend the whole show just reading those rather than getting to anything else. It's been great. I mean, Arnie's really good at navigating them. Rich and I are good at navigating them too. I think we've gotten good at navigating them. Arnie was always good at it. It worked out way better than I was expecting at first from that regard. We didn't get stuck on the messages. We use them as a way to forward the conversation. We don't read all of them. You know, we do read a good amount of them, but the ones that are irrelevant, we don't read. The worst part is when people do voice text and there's typos all over it, and then Arnie is like Anchorman and just reads it verbatim.
Heard that many times.
I mean, and we end up with like, and it's true. It's not Arnie stumbling over his words. It is that these, I will show you when we're done the text line and show you what it looks like on some cases and how indecipherable some of these messages are just because people are trying to talk to text. I had done this for about the first 10 episodes. I haven't done it a lot since, but I'm going to make you do it. Can you do an Arnie impression?
I don't know if my voice can handle it, in all honesty. I've never tried.
Well, I'm putting you on the spot. We are not hitting done on this.
Okay.
Until you give us an Arnie impression.
Yeah, is there anything specific I should say, or should just,
I know,
just
I need
wing
to,
it?
Okay. I need to have a script, but I always just do the beginning. Ah, good afternoon, everybody. You're in the huddle, all unaccounted for.
Ah, good afternoon, everybody.
Well,
you're in the huddle.
Not the worst, not the best. But not the worst.
It's more throaty. It's definitely more guttural.
It does hurt.
Yeah.
It hurts.
Yeah.
I've gotten kind of immune to it where it's okay for me, but it does hurt.
Yeah, you've gone for a while at times. I've definitely heard you.
I have gone. When Arnie's gone, I sometimes will do it like for an extended period of time just to make fun of him and make the listeners. Because I know the listeners love Arnie. Some of them say they hate him, but they all love him.
So how much of Arnie is genuine and how much is his radio personality? Or is that really just him?
I would say Arnie's a really, really good entertainer, like super good. When he's in a public forum, he acts different than he does when it's just me and him hanging out.
Yeah.
Like when he is here on the show, he's loud and bombastic. When he's playing basketball, he's loud and bombastic talking trash. When we're just hanging out at dinner, he's not like that. So his attitude is dependent. Like if the lights are on, he's got that persona. But his views are the same no matter what. Like he's not just saying he hates somebody just for the sake of the radio. If he doesn't like them, he genuinely doesn't like them. So he's just giving you his unfiltered truth. So, no, it's real. His persona gets bigger as the lights come on, but his thoughts are the same no matter where he is.
Yeah, he's a New Yorker.
It's a New Yorker. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. He's a New Yorker, just like you.
Yeah.
Well, like you used to be.
Like, I'll always be a Flatlander. I'll always be a New Yorker. Even though I've been in Vermont longer than I lived in the city.
But you've ditched your accent.
I never really... Never really thought about it that much, but I knew that I hated the sound of the Brooklyn accent, which is really wada, you know, that whole accent.
Yeah.
So I subconsciously probably worked to get rid of it.
And just like Rich did. Rich got rid of his Boston accent.
And then at one point my father lived in California, so I would spend my summers in California, and that had a whole other kind of accent. So kind of combining the two.
So you're part New Yorker, part surfer dude.
Yeah, I did surf a few times in Hawaii. I learned how to surf. But I wouldn't say I'm a surfer dude by any means.
If you end up surfing long enough, you'll end up being at the blood drive trying to get some of that blood because you'll end up, you know, I'd end up like in Forgetting Sarah Marshall with a piece of coral in my leg or something. So
yeah, well, it's more dangerous to take selfies than getting bit by a shark.
So, Brad, thank you, man. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate you being here.